So I'm Shiv Ram, and I'm going to talk about consistent and durable data structures for non-volatile byte-addressable memory. This is work I did in collaboration with my advisor, Roy Campbell, and with Neeraj and Partha while they were at HP Labs. So to start off with, recent architecture trends suggest that DRAM density scaling is facing significant challenges. And the prediction is that we'll hit a scalability wall within the next couple of generations. In response to that, there's been a lot of research recently on devices which can be used as DRAM replacements in the future. Some example of this includes devices like phase change memory and memristor, and these devices are projected to hit the market within the next couple of years or so. However, in addition to being DRAM replacements, these devices also have another interesting property that they are non-volatile. So in the sense that they can retain the charge which is stored on them and in a sense be used as replacement for storage devices. So what are the other properties that these devices are projected to have? So the access time for these devices is projected to be around 50 to 150 nanoseconds. This is in the order of DRAM access times that we have today. And these devices are also projected to be scalable, and there are high-density devices which will be available in the near future. Finally, these devices also use lower energy than DRAM, and hence we believe that these are really good candidates for storage in the future architectures. So to take a look at how these devices will fit into the storage hierarchy that we have, let's take a look at some of the access time for devices we have today. So considering the process and clock cycle to be close to 1 nanosecond, the time to access L2 cache takes about 10 nanoseconds today. The time to update something on DRAM takes on the order of 55 nanoseconds, while persistent storage devices like SLC flash and hard disk writes take about 200 microseconds to 3 milliseconds. So as you can see there, there's about three orders of magnitude difference between trying to access something in memory versus trying to store something on a persistent storage device today. So with these integration of these new devices like phase change memory or memristor, you have writes to non-volatile devices which would be on the order of 100 to 150 nanoseconds. As you can see in the figure, this is much closer to the access time for DRAM and much farther away from what we see in traditional storage devices today. So we believe this is an important reason for us to reconsider the storage hierarchy we have and how we design storage systems for these devices. So on that note, let's take a look at how data stores are designed with respect to disk-based systems today. So a typical hierarchy, you could say, would look something like this. You'd have a few layers of cache, which would be followed by a DRAM layer, and the data would be stored in disk and buffered to DRAM for reading or making updates. One could say traditional databases or file systems are a good example of this kind of a storage hierarchy. However, the amount of throughput that you can get using such a hierarchy is severely limited by the performance of the disk. With new applications requiring higher and read and write throughputs, there's been an evolution to a slightly different kind of storage hierarchy. In this case, the entire data set is stored in memory, in DRAM, and changes are made persistent by having another commit log, which is stored on disk, or by having a backing MySQL database or something like that. So some examples of this kind of a hierarchy would be Memcached clusters, which are run, or the RAMCloud project, and other in-memory databases that have been proposed in research communities. So with the advent of non-volatile memory, it's an open question as to how we are going to integrate this along with the other devices that we have. So what we are proposing in this paper is that non-volatile memory is directly made available to the applications to perform loads and stores on them. This is what we refer to as a single-level store. However, the single-level store also has more implications rather than just applications directly performing loads and stores on them. What the single-level store implies is that you now have only one copy of the data that you're operating on. So previously, we usually have a volatile copy of the data and a persistent copy of the data which is stored on the disk. Instead of that, with faster memory devices available, which are non-volatile in nature, we can afford to have a single copy of data, which is both the one which is being operated on and which is the persistent copy. And this sort of an architecture would give us better performance and also better space utilization and energy efficiency. So in that context, what are some of the challenges that we have with such a single-level store? I'm going to work through this using a small example of a binary tree which is stored on such a single-level store. So in this example, the binary tree is directly stored on non-volatile memory, and it has three nodes here, 5, 10, and 20. Now, suppose we wish to insert another node, say, with a value 15. In this case, it will be inserted below the node 20, and there are two operations that we need to perform to complete this write. So the first thing, we need to create a new node with value 15, and the second thing, we need to create a pointer from this new node to the from 20 to this new node. Right? However, their write operations can be reordered at either like cache line eviction level or at the memory controller level, and you could have writes reach the device out of order. So, for example, the write of the pointer could reach non-volatile memory before the write which creates the new node reaches the memory device. In this case, what would happen is that if there was a power failure after just the pointer has been written out, you would have a problem, you would have an inconsistent data structure. So the key challenge here is how do we make updates to data structures such that they're consistent and durable? Consistent in the sense that the data structure remains consistent after any failure which happens, and durable in the sense that we don't lose any data which we have marked as written back to the device. So that was some motivation on the problems that we'll face with the integration of non-volatile memory devices into our storage hierarchy. Right now, I'll move on to the solution which we have proposed, which is called consistent and durable data structures. And I'll work through an example of a consistent durable B-tree that we designed and implemented. Following that, I'll talk about Tembo, which is a distributed data store implementation using the consistent and durable B-tree. And finally, I'll present some evaluation for the B-tree. So what do we mean when we talk about consistent and durable data structures? So consistent and durable data structures are hardened forms of normal data structures which ensure that any updates made are consistent and durable. So if there's any failure in when an update is in progress, you can recover the data structure to a consistent state and you don't lose any previously written data. How do we do this? We use versioning to get this behavior. And the versioning is a property of the data structure which is internal to the data structure, and the external interface resembles a normal data structure to the user. So to talk a little bit more in detail about versioning, there's an atomic change from one existing version of the data structure to the next one once the update has been successfully completed. And we propose to do this using no new processor extensions, and so this can be directly applicable as soon as the devices are available. The versioning scheme that we use in our data structures today is a totally ordered one in which the version numbers are just natural numbers. And every update to the data structure creates a new version of the data structure. So if you had a data structure with one element first, inserting a new element will create the second version of the data structure. And removing an element will create the third version of the data structure, and so on. And there's one version number which is considered a little special, which we call as the last consistent version. And this last consistent version is stored in a well-known location and is useful for two reasons. So the first reason is that if you have a multi-threaded model, the last consistent version represents the most recent version at which the data structure is completely consistent. So this can be used by threads which are reading the data structure, right? And the other use case is that whenever there's a failure, the data structure can be restored to its last consistent version, and any updates which were made after that are discarded. So I'll work through an example of a consistent and durable B-tree to explain some of these concepts in greater detail. We picked a B-tree because it's a complex data structure, and it's also widely used in database systems and file systems. And we look at the structure of a consistent and durable B-tree and also some of the algorithms that we use in it. So at first glance, the B-tree node in a consistent and durable B-tree looks similar to what you would expect in a normal B-tree. Let's say the size of the B-tree node is B, and there are a number of keys which partition the B-tree node. In addition to the keys which are usually found in a B-tree node, we also have a start and end version number associated with each key. These version numbers indicate the timestamp at which the key was inserted or removed from the B-tree. To help differentiate between nodes which have been deleted and which is still present in the B-tree, we color the nodes gray if they've been deleted at a particular version, and we leave the background white to indicate a live entry. As you might notice, live entries also have a hyphen which indicates that they've not been deleted yet in their end version number. So with this structure of a consistent and durable B-tree, let's walk through some of the algorithms for it. The first one we look at is how do we perform a lookup in such a data structure? And the example I'm going to go through is trying to find key 20 at version 5 in the B-tree we have here. So as you can see, the B-tree we have here, there are three entries in each node, and there are two levels in this B-tree we have here. So at first, the lookup algorithm is reasonably similar to what you'd expect in a normal B-tree. We start from the root node, and we try to find the key which is the next largest one to the key which we are looking for. In this case, that's the first entry there, which is has a key value of 20 and is also alive at version 5. So that's probably the differentiating aspect. And we follow the pointer from that node to the child node, and we recursively repeat this process. So in this case, we find the leaf node with the entry 20, and which is also alive at version 5. So this lookup is successful, and we can return the value which has been stored in that node. So moving on, let's take a look at the insert operation. And this is where things get a little bit more interesting. So as you might remember, the key problem is how do we perform consistent and durable updates to a data structure. So in case we are inserting entries into a leaf node and the leaf node has extra room, we can directly insert the value there and make sure that none of the older values are affected. So that's a simple process. But what happens if the leaf node is full and we want to insert a new value into that? We'll take a look at a small example and work through it. In this case, the leaf node contains 5, 20, and 99, and we're trying to insert 40 into that leaf node, but the leaf node is full right now. In a traditional B-tree, we would split the existing node and we'd create two nodes, and we'd insert 40 and 99 into one and 5 and 20 into the other. However, in doing that, we might affect older versions of existing data, and if there's a failure in between, we might lose access to some of the data. So what we do here is what resembles a copy-on-write operation. So we take the old node, and we just set the end version for the keys in the old node. And we instead create two new nodes, and we push 5 and 20 into one new node, and 40 and 99 into the second new node. As you can see, the start version for the keys in the newer nodes is set to 4, which is the version number of the current update in progress. So any lookups for nodes older than 4 would go to the old node. Any lookups which come at future versions will come to these new nodes. And the other interesting fact here is that the only modification we make to the existing node is to change their end version numbers. So if there's a failure in between, the node is still intact and all the data can still be accessed. So these are some of the key properties which make sure that we get consistent and durable updates in the B-tree. As you might notice, as we make a bunch of these insert split operations, there are a lot of nodes which only have entries which have been deleted so far. So it creates it increases the height of the B-tree, and it makes it sort of less efficient in terms of space utilization and time to perform lookups. So we have a process of garbage collection, which will remove these entries which will never be looked up again in the future. As you can see, the B-tree after garbage collection is a lot more smaller, and this is efficient in terms of like future lookups are also accelerated due to this. So these are some of the examples of the operations of the B-tree. There are more algorithms for deletion and for failure recovery in the paper. And at this point, I'll move on to how we can use this consistent and durable B-tree to build a realistic data store. So we wanted to base our data store off an open source key value store, and we were looking for a system which would be a good candidate for integrating the consistent durable B-tree into. So we picked Redis, which is a widely used open source key value store, and it's used in production in a bunch of companies. And the other interesting fact about Redis is that it maintains its data set in memory. So it gave us a way to look at the what are the benefits of having a single level store by considering considering Redis. Redis traditionally uses a write ahead log on disk to maintain durability. What are the changes we made in Redis to build Tembo, which is the name of the distributed data store which we have, is that we replaced the data structure used by Redis to store data with the consistent and durable B-tree. And the concurrency model we have right now is a simple single writer shared reader concurrency model. And we're working on supporting more complex concurrency schemes. In terms of how do we distribute data between different nodes in the cluster, we use consistent hashing right now across different servers which are running on nodes. So that was a short introduction on consistent durable data structures, and we specifically saw how the B-tree is designed and implemented. Now let's move on to the evaluation to see what are the benefits we have by these design choices that we've made. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is the ease of integration. So if you're having these new class of data structures, do we need to rewrite everything, or is it going to be really hard to integrate this? So we started off with a B-tree implementation, which had about 2,100 lines of code. And we started making modifications to that to build a consistent and durable B-tree. We ended up changing, as you can see there, about like 90% of the code to build a consistent and durable B-tree. However, after that, when we were integrating this with Redis to build Tembo, we hardly changed about like 300 lines of code, which is about 1.7% of the code size of Redis. So this shows us that it involves a little bit of effort to build these data structures for the first time. But once you have them, it's really easy to integrate them into other systems. And one of the biggest reasons for this is that the interface exposed by the data structures is very similar to what you'd expect from an STL data structure today. So there's hardly any difference in how applications will use them. So moving on to the evaluation setup, we performed evaluations at three different layers. The first layer was we considered a micro benchmark between the B-tree, the consistent durable B-tree, and the B-tree in Berkeley DB, which has a transactional kind of interface. I'm not going to go into the numbers out here. They're there in the paper in the interest of time. And the second level which we compared was we had an instance of Tembo, which used the consistent durable B-tree, and we had the Redis servers, which were using write-ahead logging. So we performed comparisons in one node and also in a distributed cluster. And we also compared it to Cassandra, which is a popular NoSQL system, which has what I would call a two-layer hierarchy of storage. These experiments were performed on a 15-node cluster. 13 were treated as servers, and 2 were used for clients. And each node had about 48 GB of RAM. So you can see that there was more than half a terabyte of RAM in our test cluster. So going on to the first experiment, this was one in which we compared Tembo with the Redis server and versioning versus logging, you could say. And we performed 2 million insert operations. We only performed inserts because the lookups did not change with our data structure. And we used 2 client threads in this. And we repeated the experiment for different value sizes, and we varied it between 256 bytes to 4K. And we measured the throughput that we were getting for these different systems. So the bar on the red out here is the Redis server, which storing its data in a normal B-tree and using write-ahead logging for durability. And the bar, green bar here is Redis having a hash table as its data structure for storage and using write-ahead logging. Finally, the blue bar is Tembo, which just has a consistent and durable B-tree. As you can see, for smaller value sizes of about 256 bytes, the hash table was performing better than the other two cases. But as we were increasing the value sizes, we found that the consistent durable B-tree outperformed both the hash table and the normal B-tree with write-ahead logging. So the reason for this is that in write-ahead logging, you need to duplicate the data twice. So you need to update the log, and you also need to update the data structure in place. While in the consistent and durable B-tree, the only time we duplicate data is when we have these insert split operations. So it gets amortized over a period of time. The other point to note here is that consistent durable B-tree is always faster than B-tree plus logging, and the hash table is a little unfair comparison for the B-tree because they have different properties. Moving on, for the end-to-end cluster-wide benchmark, we used the Yahoo Cloud Serving benchmark, which is used to measure performance of NoSQL systems like HBase, Cassandra, and Peanuts, and so on. In this case, we had three configurations. The first one was just Tembo running across a cluster. And the second one was Cassandra, which is referred to as Cassandra in memory out here, was Cassandra storing its logs in memory. So Cassandra is a two-level storage hierarchy where it has an in-memory copy of the data in memtables, and it also maintains a commit log, which is stored on disk. In this case, the commit log was stored on an in-memory partition so that the operations never touch the disk, providing a fair comparison for us. And the third configuration was Cassandra storing its logs on disk, and it's just useful for reference to see how much the differences are. We varied the number of client threads we had from like 2 to 30 to see how things scale as the number of requests clients increase. And the results can be seen in the figure out here. So as you can see, Tembo performed much better than Cassandra, even storing its logs in memory by about 286%. This was primarily due to the fact that we have a single-level store where we are updating just one copy of the data versus performing multiple updates. And Cassandra also does periodic compactions of its in-memory data to store SS tables on disk. And the not having so much of overhead gives us a much better performance in Tembo. We also found another interesting thing was that Cassandra disk performed only 44% slower compared to the Cassandra in-memory configuration. This was surprising. This was a surprising result for us, and we went and checked what was the reason behind this. So it turns out that the disks we were using had great controllers, which had about 512 MB of onboard onboard memory, and they had a capacitor to make sure that any writes you made to the disk would remain persistent. So, and this was really boosting up the performance of the disk. And we repeated the experiment with the normal disk without an onboard controller, and the disk's performance was really low there. So, as I told you earlier, there are more details in the paper on algorithms used for deletion, garbage collection, recovery, and so on. We also present analysis on the amount of extra space used due to the design decisions we make. And we also discuss how we could do this on existing processes. What are the instructions that we use to get durability on existing processes? Now, in terms of related work, multi-version data structures has been looked at before in the context of transaction time databases, where you're interested in looking at all the previous existing versions of the data. We use versioning as a tool for getting consistency and consistent updates in the data structure. So, and there have also been other systems which are proposed for non-volatile memories. Examples of this include BPFS, which is a file system proposed at SOSP, and NV Heaps, which presents a transactional interface for non-volatile memory. The major difference, I think, is that we propose a single-level store in this case, where you avoid the overheads of having a file system or having any other intermediate layer of storage for the application. And the other thing is the interface we propose is going to be really similar to what existing data structures look like. So the ease of integration is an important factor. Other in-memory data stores like HStore and RAMCloud also can easily use ideas that we've proposed in this paper. So this is obviously a work in progress. We are trying to look at how we can robustly test the reliability of the protocol that we have. And we're also looking at how we could improve the concurrency model and provide transaction-like operations for updating multiple keys. And finally, we are also looking at how does versioning and wear leveling on these new devices interact with each other? Are there any benefits in that? So I'll conclude by saying that there are a lot of changes in storage media which are imminent in the next couple of years. And this is a great moment for us to look at the software stack and try to see how we're going to redesign things for them to work really well with these new devices. In this paper, we propose consistent and durable data structures in which we argue for a single level store and to provide durability through versioning. And our results show that we are up to 286% faster than memory backed systems which have the two level hierarchy. With that, I'd like to conclude and I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Haryadi Gunawi, UC Berkeley. So I would like to know your take on transactional memory, because at the end, I'm going to build complex applications, and I need to have lots of consistent updates. And with transactional memory, I have these nice abstractions of TXP and TXN. While here, it's like a bit more complex.
Right. So transactional memory is one of the candidates, I guess, for providing consistent, durable updates. I haven't compared some of the approaches we propose versus transactional memory, so I probably can't make a call about which would provide better performance. But I think it also, transactional memory might be too heavyweight for certain applications where you only want to do updates which are, where you only want consistent updates for shorter durations. So having kind of an insight on what are the exact update you want to make can make our data structures, you know, faster.
I'm Pashit from NetApp. In the numbers, you didn't show the effect of garbage collection.
Right.
Was it measured in the performance?
So I haven't explicitly quantified the overhead of garbage collection, but in the experiments we ran, we had a periodic garbage collection going on. So it would be after every 1,000 requests or every few seconds, like garbage collection would be triggered. And that has been included in the numbers that we have shown out there. Yeah.
And the second question I have is about the garbage collection itself. Does it produce more garbage when it's collecting garbage? Because everything is a copy and write.
Well, so it doesn't generate more garbage while doing garbage collection. That's because when you're doing garbage collection, you know that you're not going to look up these older versions of data. So suppose we determine that the last consistent version, like the most recent consistent version is 10, we can remove all data which has been erased before 10. So it you don't need to do a copy and write for that. You can just safely remove the data because future lookups are not going to traverse that part of the tree.
Yeah, but in the you're going to have structures for memory management to manage the area of the memory that's free or allocated.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So for those things, I thought maybe.
Right. So right now we use a ref a mark and sweep garbage collector to do this. It does result in so it's not instantaneous that you reclaim the memory, but I don't think it generates more. I mean, it has a little bit of overhead, but I don't know if it generates more memory.
A little bit. So it's eventually.
Yeah, eventually you'll reclaim the memory. Exactly. Yeah. Cool. Thank you.
Margot Seltzer from Harvard University. So I'm a little confused. Can you explain how your concurrent, consistent, and durable data structure differs from the conventional multi-version concurrency control implementation of a B-tree, which has been around for about 30 years?
Right. So I think the major difference is that we really don't want to maintain all the versions of the data structure. So versioning is just used as a tool here to get like consistent updates.
But
and we reclaim like older versions which are not used anymore.
Right. So I think you're conflating two issues. There's databases like Postgres, which wanted to support time travel and therefore keep many versions.
Right.
But long before Postgres, in the 80s, in the papers you cite on concurrency control, there's been a technique called multi-version concurrency control that does exactly this and has no indication that you would keep versions forever. You would keep them only as long as you need them. And so I'm confused how that differs from what you're doing.
Right. So I guess multi-version concurrency control is useful for providing isolation between updates and making sure that there are no conflicts. I mean, for detecting conflicts between updates. But in our structure, it's even for a single update going on, we basically use versioning to make sure that you can go back safely and recover. So I guess the difference is that if there are partial updates, using the consistent durable B-tree, you can roll back partial updates really easily, and you won't lose access to older versions of data. So I
think you need to look back at the MVCC work you cite, because that's exactly what semantics you get if you did a transaction around every single B-tree operation using MVCC.
Okay.
Konstantin Shvachko from eBay. Did you try to compare the recovery time from journaling systems and the consistent durability data? Because as far as I'm concerned, it's either the journal or you get an FSCK in the end, right?
Right. That's a great question. We haven't gotten to do that yet. That's something which we would like to explore in the near future in measuring the recovery time for different durability techniques. But off the top of my head, I can't comment on what would be better.
Do you have a feeling?
I think it depends a little bit on how you also do checkpointing. Like, if you have to replay the entire journal or if you replay parts of the journal. So I think it depends on what are the exact protocol used there. So I'm not able to make a educated guess on what would be better.
Ethan Miller, UC Santa Cruz. So it's very interesting work. One question I have is, since you've called this persistent, did you guys do any error testing where you went through and during the flush process, as you note, there's a bunch of CL flushes.
Right.
Did you do any error testing where you said, okay, stop after the first one and try to recover?
Right. So that's exactly what I was referring to when I said robust reliability testing. So we are trying to come up with a harness where you can stop it after any random CL flush and try to get an image of the memory at that point and try to make sure that it's consistent. But we're still working on that and trying to fit that together. Yep.
Seems like it'd be pretty straightforward. Just, you know, you have a piece of code that does flush A, B, C. Go in and modify the code and say, okay, stop after A.
Right. But what happens is in at least Intel-based architectures, you always get a cache coherent view of the system. So even if another app process tries to read memory, it still gets a cache coherent view. So what you want to do is you want to invalidate the caches and try to get a cache incoherent view. And that's kind of tricky. Yeah. Cool. Thank you.
Nandu from the RAMCloud project at Stanford.
Hi.
I have a question for you about your key value store. Did you handle node failures of any sort in your key value store? You know, you compared it against Cassandra and so on.
Right.
So durability is at the level of a single node? Or is it across nodes?
So right now it's at a single node because there is no because the keys are independent of each other, so they're not correlated with other keys which is stored elsewhere.
I see. So if one of the nodes in your 15 node cluster, say your test cluster, would go down.
Right. You replicate the nodes onto another. You replicate the keys in a particular node onto the other node by maintaining multiple replicas. So the other node will just take over serving of those keys right now. Yeah.
I see.
Bill Belosky from Microsoft. So you end up having to attach version numbers to pretty much everything. How
right.
Do you have to make the version numbers 64 bits so they don't overflow, or is there some way you can get around?
So right now we have 64-bit numbers on versioning. That's a good question. And I don't have an, I think you can safely reuse version numbers if you have management scheme which lets you know what version follows the other. So I think there'll be a little bit of overhead for that, but we haven't implemented it yet.
Okay. Yeah, because otherwise
you'd run out of
version. I mean, you have like two things as big as a pointer attached to each other.
Right, and it adds space overhead, true, yeah.
Hi, this is Andy Twigg from Kunu. First of all, I completely agree with Margot. The split algorithms you use are basically exactly the same as the scheme of Becker, right? Which I just checked, and you cite it, but you don't ever reference it, I think, from within the text, if I'm right.
Okay.
The second point I had is about sort of performance comparisons. So you've got 700 gigs of RAM or so, and you're doing 2 million inserts.
Right.
So a lot of these NoSQL systems, as you mentioned, you know, Cassandra and things that want to do commit logs, they really want high write speeds.
Right.
And have you looked at what sort of write speeds you get with your B-tree-based schemes on disk?
Right. So the benchmark that we were running out here, it had a 50% read and 50% write workload, like the Cassandra benchmark we have out here. So I would say it's a write-heavy workload already. So this is, I mean, traditionally you don't see a 50% read, 50% write unless
but
you
are
have...
But hitting disk at this point?
No, the Cassandra in memory doesn't really touch the disk at all. So it just stores its commit logs on an in-memory partition. That's pretty much what it does, right?
Okay, yeah, it just worries me that you're not going to be able to maintain any sort of write performance as soon as you hit disk. You're going to go through, you're just going to fall through the floor.
So write performance does suffer when you start to hit disk. That's a good observation. But I guess the argument is that in future looking storage hierarchies, maybe we can get away without that. And then we'd get a really good write performance combined with great read throughputs too, right?
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
Hi, Michael Condit, NetApp again, sorry. You call this a single level store presumably because you are viewing it as executing directly from the persistent store, but you're not. It's really you've reduced a four level store to a three level store, and the CPU is executing instructions out of level one cache. But let's assume that what you really mean is that there aren't two copies of the data, one form that you execute instructions on and a different form that you store persistently.
Right.
Okay, that style of programming can already be done today. First of all, we do that already for the read-only portion of a program. It's demand paged into RAM, and RAM is just a cache.
Right. Right.
Okay. And secondly, if you use memory mapped files for all of your data structures, then
right.
you're programming in that architecture, right?
Right.
So we don't have to wait 2 years to do this.
Well, it's partly true. Memory map files closely resemble having just a single level of storage. However, there you explicitly manage things about like flushing things back to disk when things are safe to flush back to disk, right?
And we don't have to, as long as you're going to correct all the errors.
Right. That's true. Great.
All right, thanks. That concludes the specializing storage session.